Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for May's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European and RCVS recognized specialist in small animal surgery orthopaedics, Hans Bergman. Thank you, Hans. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Ema. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this webinar on external skeletal fixation. I hope you can hear me. If there's any problem, please give me an indication. In today's webinar, we will briefly talk about general indications, advantages and disadvantages of external skeletal fixation, but we will then discuss in greater detail various components, basic principles and clinical application of external skeletal fixation. The post-operative management of patients undergoing external skeletal fixation is also something that is very important to cover. We will talk about bandaging, when repeat radiography is necessary, and we will also talk about destaging of the frame briefly. And this optimal post-operative management is very, very crucial to successful application of an external skeletal fixator. This can also contribute significantly to reduce the frequency and severity of complications. So what are indications of external skeletal fixation? External skeletal fixation is an effective method of fracture repair and may be used in a variety of clinical situations, including simple or highly comminuted fractures. But ESF is also commonly preferred to internal fracture fixation as soon as extensive soft tissue damage is present. And overall, I also commonly use external skeletal fixation in fractures that take overall longer to heal than expected, or in fractures that do not show any healing potential anymore, such as non-unions. And the additional stability provided by an external skeletal fixation fixator is usually the only thing what needs to be done in order to support the healing of infected fractures. Advantages of external skeletal fixation over other techniques of fracture repair is if a frame is applied properly, there's only minimal disruption of soft tissues and minimal disturbance of the blood supply to the bone. And external skeletal fixation also allows kind of a straightforward post-operative adjustment of alignment and rigidity. And this is a big advantage, especially when you have performed internal fracture fixation, you perform radiographs and identify that screw is where you didn't want it to be. And in order to get this corrected, you have to go back into theater. And with an external skeletal fixation, usually you might be able to, insert a pin more, remove a pin, and even you might be able to add an additional pin without going into theater. And then eventually the entire frame can be removed after the fracture has completely healed, and this can be done without performing a major surgery. And this is another big advantage compared to internal fracture fixation, where a surgery is usually necessary to remove implants. There are, however, also disadvantages of external skeletal fixation when we compare it to other fixation techniques. For instance, pin tract infections do occur quite commonly, especially if a frame needs to stay on for a longer period, and I'm talking 4 to 6 weeks or longer, then there is very often a pin tract that gets infected, especially when a pin had to be placed through soft tissue, quite large soft tissue areas. And pin tractions in general are, however, rarely of clinical significance, and they normally respond well to either frequent bandaging changes using antibiotics or removal of the frame. What external skeletal fixators do compared to internal fixation is they require a much greater degree of owner compliance, which can be considered an advantage. I have the experience that owners are very well coping with patients undergone external fracture fixation. So it's not only needed to clean and monitor the device more frequently compared to internal fixation, owner also must be more careful to ensure that an additional damage does not occur to the animal or the device. And there's also more veterinary aftercare required. For instance, more recheck appointments might be needed, and very often radiographs need to be repeated more often. So usually I do radiographs, or recommend radiographs to be done 6 weeks after the surgery, but most patients then also need another radiograph at week 9 or week 12, depending on the healing progress. More rigid type 2 or type 3 frames can not be used for fractures of the femur and humerus, and this is due to the inability to place connecting bars on the medial aspect of either of these bones. But tie-in pins, for example, can be used instead, and distally placed full pins can be connected to the lateral frame to provide additional stability. So I regularly apply modify type 2 frames to the femur and the humerus. Let's talk about components. So pins or wires are generally used in external fixation to transfix bone fragments. And each pin or wire is then functionally anchored to a connecting bar or to a connecting rod by either a clamp or to a connecting ring by bolts. The pins can also be connected without clamps using acrylic. Pins and K-wires that are commonly used to as transfixation elements are generally made of stainless steel and usually have a troca tip. And various designs are available, including smooth and threaded types. If you compare the threaded to the smooth pins, positive and negative threaded pins demonstrate superior axial pullout strength compared to smooth pins, and my recommendation is to use threaded pins as often as possible. Now, we have mentioned positive threaded pins and negative threaded pins, so what is the difference? The inner diameter of positive threaded pins is equal to the shaft diameter, and this is the major difference to negative threaded pins, where the inner thread diameter is smaller than the shank diameter. So as positive profile pins with, for example, cancellous thread can be used to transfix metaphyseal regions of long bones, cortical threaded pins are used to transfix dense lamellar bone of cortices located in the diaphysis of long bones. And what is the difference between cancellous and cortical threaded pins? The cancellous threaded pins feature a deeper thread with a larger pitch compared to cortical threaded pins. Negative profile pins have usually a fine thread design and are usually intended to be inserted into areas of high lamellar bone density. For example, the diaphysis of long bones is one of those indications. So I've mentioned the inner diameter of those negative threaded profile pins are, as I say, smaller than the shank diameter. And what is the problem with negative threaded pins? The difference in diameter at the thread shaft interface generally can generate a stress riser effect, which makes negative profile pins much more susceptible to high bending moments and can result in implant failure at this location. Threaded transfixation pins are either classified as full pins, central threaded pins, or half pins and threaded pins. Full pins or central threaded pins penetrate the skin surface, then transfix through the near and far cortices of the bone, and then penetrate the skin surface on the far cortex side. And when are full pins used? Full pins are used in type 2A frames, type 2B frames. I will talk about the different types of frames in a few minutes. And they're also used as the medial lateral transfixation pin components of type 3 frames. When are half pins used? They are usually penetrating skin on the near but not on the far cortex, but it's important that both cortices are penetrated. Half pins are used for type 1A and type 1B frames, are used as the central components of type 2B frames, and are also used as the cranial pin components of type 3 frames. So they have quite significant indications. On the pictures here, I wanted to show the difference between the full pins and the half pins. If you look at this picture on the top, here we can see a full pin. You can't see the thread, which is within the bone. And then you can see further down half pins that are placed, and down there there's another full pin. And this is a external fixator that is applied on a dog, on the left tibia of the dog. It was a comminuted fracture, and we decided that the application of an external fixator is the right choice. And what you can see on the bottom picture is the insertion of one of those half pins through the clamps. We will talk about how to insert those pins later on, but placing half pins after two full pins have already been in the bone and the connecting bars are applied is much easier than placing an additional full pin. I'll talk about this later as well. So what are other components? Connecting bars are connecting transfixation pins to the fixation frame via usually pin connecting bar clamps. Those connecting bars can be composed of a variety of materials, including stainless steel, aluminium, carbon fiber, and acrylic, and titanium is also occasionally used. And they are available in several sizes and length, and what I usually keep in stock is steel connecting bars for small dogs and cats, and I have a large variety of usually carbon fiber rods for medium to large breed dogs. External skeletal fixation clamps are available in both single and double clamp models, and what those clamps usually have is an opening for the fixation pin and usually a separate opening for connecting bars. The most commonly used clamps are the KE clamps and the SK clamps from IMEX and the Secure U clamps from Securos. When we use KE clamps, we need to be aware that there are significant limitations to the newer systems. For example, when we apply KE clamps, we have to apply all the clamps to the connecting bar before we apply the pins, especially when two full pins are placed and the connecting bars are applied, then it is very difficult to modify the number of clamps. It's difficult to get the clamps off and on. Overall, the KE clamps cannot be removed without removing the entire connecting bar from the frame. Another limitation is the potential for acute structural deformity when we use KE clamps, and this deformation can weaken the clamp over time, which reduces the number of times a KE clamp can be reused. And one of the biggest advantages of using KE clamps was the affordability. Nowadays, the newer systems such as the SK or SF or Secure systems are significantly cheaper compared to 5 years ago. And when you put the initial, maybe a little higher cost of new systems against the less cost of KE clamps, you can use the SK clamps for much longer. So eventually, it might not be cheaper to go for a KE system. What is another advantage of the newer systems, or disadvantage of the KE clamps, is that newer clamp designs usually provide a greater modularity and are generally easier to apply, and this especially would be nice from a beginner's point of view. In general, there are different external skeletal fixation systems available, such as linear frames, circular external fixation, hybrid, and free forms. Linear frames are commonly used for fixation of comminuted fractures, whereas angular deformities are commonly treated with circular external fixations. Hybrid frames can be a great choice to treat fractures that are close to a joint, where, for example, it might not be possible to insert a sufficient number of transfixation pins into the fragments. Free forms are very useful in treating fractures such as mandibular fractures, where the application of linear systems can be quite tricky due to anatomical circumstances. Although a large variety of linear external skeletal fixation designs are commercially available, the KE system has become the most important linear external skeletal fixation design for use in small animal veterinary orthopedics. There are, as already mentioned, systems available such as the SK or SecureU that show much greater modularity and superior mechanical properties. So if you look at a picture here, we have one of those SK systems. This is an IMEX system, the connecting bars, the clamps. This is a SecureU clamp, where you can see how this clamp can be put onto a frame quite easily. And this is one of the more traditional KE systems available. Linear external skeletal fixation systems using transfixation pins that are connected with a single connecting bar are called type 1A frame. And those type 1A frames are used for fixation of simple fractures in smaller dogs or in cats. These frames are unilateral and uniplanar, and they are known to be the least rigid of all the linear external skeletal fixation types available, but they are also less bulky compared to more complex frames. And in using more advanced systems, newer systems, it might be possible to fix a fracture with a type 1A frame compared to a KE system that might need type 2A or B to be applied. So the newer systems can allow to apply less bulky systems. A type 1B frame is composed of two connecting bars, which you can see here. One connecting bar, the second connecting bar, and those two frames on each side, they are usually opposed 90 degrees to each other. This unilateral biplanar frame can overall be used to fix radial and tibial fractures. So my preference to fix radial fractures is the type 1B, where I'm quite happy to apply a type 2 in a tibia. But the application of a type 1B frame onto a radius I find very, very tricky. A type 2A or type 2B frame is composed of two connecting bars that are opposed 180 degrees to each other. And this frame design can be used to treat more complex fractures and are useful in large breed dogs. But there is a problem. The design does not allow these frames to be applied in fractures that are proximal to the elbow or the stifle. Type 3 external skeletal fixation frames are created by connecting three bars. Two connecting bars are opposed 180 degrees to each other, which you can see here. There's one and there's two. So this is a bilateral biplanar frame. And the second plane is, you can see here. So this frame is usually then placed on the cranial surface, for example, of the tibia, and is 90 degrees opposed to the other two connecting bars. Those type 3 frames are known to be the most rigid frames of all the linear frames available. Circular external skull fixation can be used to stabilize a variety of fractures, such as long bone fractures, spinal fractures, but also are indicated to treat luxations. I mentioned that circular fixation frames are highly suitable to correct angular limb deformities, but you know, I also have done arthrodesis successfully with circular external fixations. In order to gain optimal mechanical stability, four rings are usually used to secure four pairs of wires that are placed as perpendicular as the soft tissue anatomy allows. And the smallest ring diameter allowing a minimum of 2 centimeters between the skin and the ring is used. The use of small diameter tensioned wires can provide adequate stability to bone segments, but they also allow controlled axial micromotion at the fracture site, which is great from a healing point of view. And this would not usually compromise the fixator's stability. If the wire tension is increased, this will also increase the bending and axial stiffness, but overall the torsional stiffness is reduced. And if you compare a 1.6 millimeter tension pin to an untensioned 1.6 millimeter pin, the tensioned one is as strong as a 4 millimeter pin. And one wire is usually placed proximal, and one wire is usually placed distal to each ring to prevent interference while inserting the pins. Maximal stability with minimal sharing forces can be overall achieved if the wires intersect at 90 degrees, so that's the ideal world. However, wires must often intersect at less than 90 degrees to avoid important neurovascular structures. Acrylic-based external skeletal fixation systems use acrylic columns that function both as connecting bars and as bar clamps. With acrylic systems, all transfixation pins are angled out of plane, and as long as the acrylic column engages all fixation pins, the construct usually achieves adequate stability for fracture healing, but this stability is usually a downside of the acrylic frame. So if you compare acrylic frames with linear frames, the linear frames tend to be more stable compared to acrylic. But acrylic can provide a very lightweight and still strong mechanical option and can be more economical compared to the conventional linear systems. When a comminuted fracture is stabilized with external skeletal fixation, we anticipate secondary bone healing, and that's the reason why perfect reduction is not desired, but we need to apply certain principles of fracture healing, so the fragments must not be apart more than a centimeter in order for a fracture to successfully heal. And increased rigidity of the fixator frame can also result in more rapid clinical union. So our aim is to create a frame that is as strong as possible. So numerous studies have been performed to evaluate the overall strength and the stiffness of external skeletal fixation used in veterinary and human medicine, and the knowledge of the overall mechanical strength and stiffness of the external skeletal fixation construct is important for fracture management. And there are several factors that influence the resulting biomechanics of the construct, for example, the frame geometry, the size of the connecting bars, and the diameter, the number, and the location of the various transfixation pins. And I now want to go through different possibilities to increase the rigidity of a frame. So an insufficiently strong frame will be at a high risk to cause complication, whereas an overly rigid frame can be destabilized to a less rigid frame as the healing progresses. So one possibility to increase the strength and the stiffness of a frame is to increase its complexity. So type 1A, 1B, 2A, 2B, and type 3 linear external skeletal fixations are successfully stronger in resisting axial and torsional loads, with the exception that a type 1B frame has a greater resistance to shear forces than a type 2 frame. Type 1A and 1B frame configurations are usually considered to provide ideal stabilization for simple fractures, while type 2 and type 3 frame configurations are mechanically more suited for the treatment of complex fractures in dogs and cats. The incorporation of larger diameter connecting bars into an external skeletal fixation frame will result in greater stiffness of the fixator, and large diameter carbon fiber rods, which I very often use, can add significant strength to a frame without adding significant weight to it, which is a huge advantage. In addition, carbon fiber rods are radiolucent, and this allows radiographic visualization of the fracture. A shorter working length of a pin increases its resistance to a bending moment and therefore the overstiffness of the frame. So what we should try to do is bringing the connecting bar and the clamps as close as possible to the bone. However, we must avoid soft tissue impingement. So a general rule of thumb is that one forefinger should be inserted between the clamps and the skin, which is approximately 1 centimeter. And this way, soft tissue impingement can be avoided, but the connecting bar is as close as possible to the bone. So though type 1A frames, or generally type 1 frames, are generally considered to be weaker in terms of strength and stiffness than other frame configurations, the addition of a second connecting bar on a type 1A frame will increase the frame's resistance to axial stiffness by a factor of 2.5. And it's also interesting to note that the mechanical gain in stiffness achieved by adding a second connecting bar to, for example, a type 1A frame is approximately the same as a type 2B frame, and is approximately 50% of the mechanical stiffness of a type 2A frame. The external skeletal fixation frame can be strengthened in animals with a low fracture assessment score by adding diagonal connecting bars. And in this picture here, you can see a bent connecting bar here running from the medial side of a full pin placed in the distal tibia, connecting one of the most proximal pins laterally on the femur. And these additional connecting bars can either be connected with single clamps or with double clamps to either the pins or existing connecting bars. Humeral and femoral fractures we mentioned, it can be quite tricky to apply external skeletal fixation. However, the addition of an IM pin can significantly increase the strength of those frames. And these IM pins are very often used with a type 1A or a type 1B frame, and those IM pins can either stand alone or, what you can see here, they can either connect it with the external frame. So we call this a tie-in IM pin construct. And this is something what I try to do as much as possible. So this tie-in can increase the strength tremendously as well. Another way to increase the rigidity of the frame is to increase the pin diameter. And if the pin diameter is increased, the pin stiffness is increasing exponentially. So it's not a linear relationship. Hence, getting as large a pin into the bone as possible is of huge importance. The optimal pin size diameter to use with an ESF system will be influenced by the diameter of the bone fragments present. So the bone hole created to get a larger pin and can act as a stress riser, and this would weaken the bone in torsion and bending. And in order to prevent a stress riser effect of the bone hole created by the inserted pin, the diameter of the pin should not exceed 30% of the diameter of the bone. So this is a rule of thumb. Most of the time I'm at 20% of the diameter. Occasionally I approach the 30%, but I try to be at 20%. Stress reduction at the pin-bone interface will decrease the incidence of bone resorption around the pin and subsequent the loosening of the frame. So unlike smooth transfixation pins, or positive profile pins can be placed perpendicular to the long axis of the bone. And this allows less interference from adjacent pins during insertion, and this also allows the opportunity to place more pins per fragment depending on the fracture position. In order to increase pin-bone interface purchase of smooth pins, they are usually placed at a 70 degree angle to the long axis of the bone. This far near near far principle is something that I want to explain in more detail. So transfixation pins should ideally be evenly spaced along the length of each fragment to decrease the stress forces that develop at each interface point. The pins should be placed no closer than 3 times their diameter, or half of the diameter of bone from joints and fracture edges. So if you look at this picture here, you can see here the pins are evenly spread out. So there's the proximal, the far, then we have the two near pins, and then we have the far pins again. And if you compare this construct with a construct here, we see much more displacement after axial force is applied if the pins are not spread out evenly. The external skeletal fixation frame stiffness can also be increased if we increase the number of transfixation pins by using, for example, 6 to 8 pins per construct, so 3 to 4 pins proximal and 3 to 4 pins distal. In cases where fragments are transfixed with a lesser number of pins, we see a higher tendency to loosening. Placing more than 4 pins per fragment does, however, not add additional stiffness, so there is no need to do that. Before an external skeletal fixation system is placed, it is important for the surgeon to consider the degree of invasiveness that will be required to stabilize the patient. So proper aseptic technique, including patient preparation, gloving, gowning, draping, and instrument preparation, that's just as important as for any other fixation methods. If you look at fractures of the radius and the tibia, the patient can be positioned in dorsal recumbency, and for doing the aseptic preparation. However, this position can be maintained while the external skeletal fixation is applied. So the limb can be suspended from hooks in the ceiling, or intravenous stent can be used. If the fixation is applied to a humerus or a femur, the patient usually needs to be positioned in lateral recumbency. So before any external skull fixation system is applied, it is important for the surgeon to decide, you know, which approach to take. So most fractures of the radius, the tibia, the femur, and the humerus may be treated in a closed fashion. What are the advantages? A closed approach decreases the surgical time. It decreases the disruption to the local blood supply, and this overall speeds up the healing significantly. The local blood supply will only be minimally disturbed with the so-called open but do not touch approach. However, an open approach might be necessary when bone fragments overlap or when they are markedly displaced, when they are angled and rotated. So in all those circumstances where the fragment apposition cannot be improved with closed manipulation. An open approach might also be required for placement of cancellous bone. In linear external skeletal fixation systems, the most proximal and the most distal pins are usually inserted first. The connecting bars are attached and the pins closest to the fracture or osteotomy site are then inserted next. Pins of the central area of the bone fragments are usually placed last. What I usually do is making 5 to 10 millimeter skin incisions with a scalpel blade wherever I want to insert a pin. For example, here you can see making a skin incision, so incise the skin, and I actually try to also incise the periost with the scalpel blade. However, I can also or very often use a forceps, a thumb forceps, to get the periost a little bit away from the bone. So when we look at further pictures down the line, so the first pin was inserted, which you can see here. Then we insert the next pin distally, so we make another skin incision. Here you can see, so that's the skin incision. Here you can see that I use a forceps to help with dissecting the hole a bit. So when I pre-drill or insert the pin, that the soft tissue doesn't get impinged. And the next step is pre-drilling. It's important that you try to prevent heat formation in doing a low speed drilling, and also use flush to help. And then next step, after both full pins are applied, I check the alignment, I check the length of the bone, I check if there's any rotational deficit. So this can be done with the knee being flexed in 90 degrees and the hock being flexed in 90 degrees, and I look that the metatarsus here is parallel to the femur. And I can use those two pins here to distract the bone if I am suspicious of a significant deficit of length. After the connecting bars are applied, which you can see here, so two full pins are placed, the connecting bars are applied, I then check again, is it okay? If I'm happy with the position, I then start tightening the clamps and check the position again. If there's any problem, you can undo a clamp, you know, rotate the leg a little bit, increase the length, decrease the length, so it's quite easy to adjust while applying the external fixator. Then we start applying the additional pins. So this is a fracture quite distal of the tibia, and I was initially not sure if I can get two additional half pins distally, so I started with a pin close to the joint and try to then see what happens next. So in this picture on the top you see that we insert the half pin through the clamp distally, we insert another half pin through the clamp proximally, and move forward. When applying free forms, all pins are placed first and are then connected with acrylic last. So this is different to linear skeletal fixation. Here you can see a free form. The main reason of using this free form in this case is I did not have enough linear components available. I just did another fracture repair the day before using all the small steel connecting bars and the tiny clamps, and there was not enough time to get the new stuff in, so I just decided to use this free form in this patient. To prevent direct mechanical damage to bone during insertion of positive profile pins in general, it is recommended to create a pilot hole with a drill bit that is sized slightly smaller than the shank pin diameter. This twist channel of the drill bit allows the escape of debris while drilling, and this minimizes frictional heat. And this is a significant difference compared to drilling a hole with a pin, which is causing much more heat development. So with pre-drilling, the mechanical damage and the heat generation is significantly reduced. And this way, the pull-out strength of a pin will be significantly increased and the risk of pin loosening is decreased. The method of transfixation pin placement used is critical for the pin-bone interface. If you're using a handheld chuck, so Jacob's chuck, for insertion of a pin or for pre-drilling, if it's not done carefully, then marked wobbling can occur during the insertion, and this can create a functionally larger bone hole than necessary, which then can lead to poor pin-bone contact and might cause premature pin loosening. So here you can see that there is quite a significant radial lucency present. So this was not the case straight away at postoperative radiographs, but after 3 weeks this pin started to become loose, and x-rays showed that this pin was loose. When using power drill insertion, it is critical to keep the speed of insertion low to reduce the development of pin heat during insertion. And this way, the potential for bone necrosis and bone resorption at the pin-bone interface is significantly reduced. And cooling with sterile saline, for example, or Hartmann's, can also help to reduce thermal necrosis. That's something what we discussed before. Each fixation pin should be drilled into the bone at the point of greatest cross-sectional diameter. Pins in the proximal third of the tibia very often are placed in the cranial third of the bone rather than at its greatest cross-sectional diameter, which is usually farther further caudally. But in general terms, the cranial part of the tibia can be much easier palpated than the caudal ones, and there's always a tendency to do that. In most of the cases, it's not a problem, but if you only have space for two or three pins, then you know it's really crucial to you know maximize the bone purchase. When we place half pins, it is important that the pins penetrate both cortices, which you can see here, so the near and the far cortex, and the tip of the half pin should at least be penetrating the cortex 2 to 3 millimeter, but half pins do not penetrate through the far cortex, skin. Fractures of the radius and tibia, if you now go through various clinical applications, so radial and tibial fractures can be stabilized with type 1A, type 1B, type 2A, type 2B, and even type 3 frames are possible in the tibia. I don't use type 3 frames in the radius, there is too much soft tissue damage possible. So type 1A frames with newer system components will produce adequate stabilization for relatively simple fractures, even in larger breed dogs. But usually the type 1A frames are used in small breed dogs and cats. Type 1B, 2A and 2B frames are indicated to stabilize comminuted fractures of radius and the tibia, and typically those pins are inserted on the medial or craniomedial border of the radius. This is helping to prevent soft tissue impingement. Alternatively, pins can be placed in a more craniomedial and craniolateral oblique line along the length of the radius in smaller patients, because it might be tricky, considering the anatomy of the radius, to do this in a more craniolateral fashion. But the craniolateral position of proximal pins will help to reduce the potential for the implant to interfere with elbow function. So it's always kind of a combination to avoid soft tissue impingement, to help avoiding interference with neighboring joints. So it's always a compromise. I use hybrid linear circular external fixations regularly in radial and tibial fractures if there is one fragment quite short, preventing insertion of enough linear, so enough fixation pins to create a linear frame. And for those kind of in those kind of cases, the ring can be placed onto the shorter fragment, and then a type 1B frame can be applied with one plane of pins inserted, for example, on the medial edge, and the other pin plane can be located at the cranial surface of the tibia. And if you look at the general outcome of fracture repair of radius tibia with external skeletal fixation, we have quite an excellent outcome. It's 95% for bone union and 91% for good to excellent limb function. An open proximal radial growth plate and a relatively short proximal radius make the repair of this fracture rather challenging. So what we have decided to do here is, instead of applying a ring proximally, we have kind of not really cheated, but what we have done is we have inserted the pins distally into the radius and proximally one pin into the radius, but then we used the ulna to get bone purchase proximal. This is something what I would be quite happy to do in dogs. In cats, I would be a little bit more careful because the cats are a little bit more sensitive when the pronation and supination of the elbow joint is restricted. Type 1 and type 1A and type 1B fixators can be applied also in humeral and femoral fractures in cats and dogs, but in medium to small large breed dogs, usually something needs to be added to increase the strength of the fixator. It's, as we discussed before, not possible to apply a proper type 2 or type 3 fixator onto humerus or femur because of anatomical circumstances. So intramedullary pins can be very useful to develop stronger bone fixation, especially in larger dogs with humeral or femoral fractures. Hybrid type 1 or type 2 fixators can also be constructed so that, for example, food pins can be used at the most distal aspect and half pins can be used at the more proximal aspect. Half pins for type 1A and 1B configurations on the humerus are usually placed in kind of lateral or craniolateral position, and the main reason is to avoid the muscle bellies. Care should, however, be taken at the distal third of the humerus because we know there's the radial nerve close, and that's something we need to really preserve. In femoral fractures, we can place the pins in lateral or cranio-lateral positions as well, but we will always penetrate the quadriceps or biceps femoris muscle, which can cause a lameness. So in this patient, a comminuted fracture of the distal third of the humeral shaft was repaired with a type 1A frame, and consolidation of the fracture was confirmed after 9 weeks. We mentioned the use of a tie-in construct, so that works functionally very well for the humerus, and I prefer or very much like using IM pins into the humerus. I also quite regularly apply it into the femur, but we see occasionally more mechanical lameness when they are applied on the femur. So what we can then or need to decide is what to do with the IM pin when we place it. I usually place it in an anterograde fashion to make sure that we reduce the risk of sciatic nerve impingement, but I usually try to tie those IM pins in with the remaining construct. So larger dogs may require larger fixator frames with additional fixator pins, but this is then also increasing the risk of soft tissue interference. When we use newer fixation systems and positive threaded pins, in general terms, fewer pins are needed. External skeletal fixation can also be used to stabilize mandibular fractures, they can be open or closed, they can be simple or comminuted, and what is important is to look at the proper dental occlusion and the function of the temporomandibular joints. It's less important to be 100% perfect with the reduction itself. Usually we apply type 1A frames, and it's important to insert those pins ventral to the mandibular canal for two reasons. We have less risk of damaging neurovascular structures, and there's also less risk of tooth root damage. And the overall success rate is reported to be 84%. We use external skeletal fixation also commonly to treat angular limb deformities. So external skeletal fixation is highly adaptable. We can adjust the frame post operatively, and it allows us to progressively correct the angles of a deformity. And if we have a significant bone defect, then we can also distract the bones gradually, so using distraction osteogenesis. Simpler deformities are usually treated with osteotomies, and we then can do an acute correction and apply a type 1A frame. For more complex deformities, then circular external fixation is highly useful. We can either then correct the actual deformities acutely at the time of the osteotomy, or we can use the frame for initially only axial distraction and bone length enhancement, or use hinges for a more progressive angular and axial distraction. External skeletal fixation can also be used to fix joints. So indications are sharing wounds, fractures close to a joint, traumatic luxations, ligament, tendon injuries. So a huge number of indications, and it's usually a type 1A or a type 2 frame. Type 1A frame can be applied in simple injuries such as tarsal luxations in small dogs and cats, whereas type 2 frames are then needed in larger dogs or dogs where patients in general terms where we have a more severe joint laxity or where healing times are expected to be quite long. So here you can see transarticular fixator. We have seen that before. What is important to remove these kind of constructs after 6 weeks to make sure that we don't get any significant intraarticular damage. So another thing what I have not mentioned before is the pin tract management. So the overall idea is to reduce the number of microorganisms present at the pin tract, which usually significantly reduces the risk of pin loosening. But pin loosening can also be reduced inserting the pins properly and in using ideally positive threaded pins. Another way to treat pin tracts in an optimal way is to reduce the soft tissue motion around it. So we can use padding, we can make larger skin incisions to make sure that the soft tissues are not impinging with the pins. And another important factor is to allow drainage of accumulating fluid. In regards to post-operative management, it is optional if topical antiseptics are used. I usually use either povidone iodine ointments or Yodosorb or some chlorhexidine ointment. So I regularly do that, but I know many colleagues who don't worry about applying topical antiseptics. And what I usually do is I place sterile gauzes around the pins and between the skin and the frame. So that's what I'm doing here. Just using sterile gauzes and wrap it around the pins. This helps to reduce movement. This helps to reduce inflammation and swelling. An alternative is the use of chlorhexidine-soaked sponges, but making sure that those sponges have been rinsed beforehand. Otherwise, the chlorhexidine concentration might be too much. I keep the entire leg bandaged for the first 7 days, and after 7 days, when the pin tracts are healed, the swelling has gone down, I usually apply bandage only on the frame. In regards to the frequency of bandage changes, I usually change the bandage a day after surgery. Patients are then discharged to the referring vet, and the next bandage change is usually recommended after 3 to 7 days if the pin tracts are healing well, or daily if there is a problem with the pin tracts. Question about antibiotics. I'm using antibiotics as little as possible, but application of external fixators usually I feel better to use antibiotics for the first 7 days or until the pin tracts are healed. Then I stop antibiotics and would only start them again if the pin tracts start causing problems. So here you can see a picture of a hybrid external fixator applied in a tibial fracture, community tibial fracture. You can see the ring here and a type 1B frame here. I usually keep the pins long before I do radiographs. I do some cleaning, which you can see here at the top and right picture. So it's all clean. Then we move into x-rays, check the position of the pins, then modify the position, insert pins a little bit more, take them out a little bit to maximize, optimize the pin wire location, and then we do more cleaning and cut the pins, which you can see here. And then you can see here I'm using Yodosorb, which I just apply onto the pin tracts. And then I pack those pin exit sites with sterile gauzes as discussed, and also put some goes between skin and the connecting bars, just reduce the soft tissue movement as much as I can. And then after usually 7 days, the frame only needs to be covered with even non-sterile wraps, mainly to prevent automutilation and to, you know, make sure that the implants are protected. And that's usually the case when the granulation tissue has formed at the pin exit site. And in these kind of cases, rechecks are only needed every week. If we have a problem with the pin tract, so if it's an inflammation or an infection, we most of the time can be successful if we, you know, clean the pin tract more regularly and, you know, just increase the frequency of bandage changes. Occasionally some debridement needs to be done and the addition of antibiotics might solve the problem. And in a few cases, we then need to remove or replace the pins. I usually recommend radiographs to be taken at 6 to 8 weeks, but ideally we should take them at 3 to 4 weeks and at 12 weeks. And most frames are removed after 6 to 8 weeks. And what can also be done is to kind of destabilize the frame, to downsize a frame from a type 3 to a type 2 or a type 2 to a type 1. And after the frame is removed, I usually keep a bandage on for up to 3 days and recommend to walk on a lead for another 3 to 4 weeks. And then I mentioned the destabilization, usually done after 6 weeks. This, you know, I mentioned the downstaging from a type 3 to a type 2, or here you can see a type 1B to a kind of a type 1A frame, apart from this pin distal here. Whenever we do radiographs or assess the frame, it's important to remove, first of all, loose pins. If an IM pin has been placed, this is usually the first implant I remove, or if all the loose pins are removed and the IM pin is removed and I still want to further destabilize the frame, then I usually remove the pins that are closest to the fracture site. And what are common complications? We have mentioned a few: pin tract infection, pin loosening, implant breakage, and fracture of the bone proximal or distal to the construct. But in most of the cases, these major complications can be avoided by proper application of the frame. The fracture healing, occasionally we see longer than expected fracture healing with external skeletal fixations, but this does not necessarily mean it's the fixator's fault. It might just be the indication this external skeletal fixator has been chosen to be used. For example, you know, more complex fractures, more comminuted fractures, open fractures are treated with an ESF, but it's just a primary injury that is usually the cause for longer than expected healing. What are the complications? Reduction of range of motion. Occasionally, minor hemorrhage can be seen. And yes, sciatic nerve and radial nerve. These are the nerves that are really important to be protected. All right, so we have now come to the end of this webinar. I think time-wise, I have not spoken too long. So I'm now happy to answer any questions. So any questions? I have one question in regards to the placement of an IM pin. You know, how can an IM pin placed still guaranteeing a closed approach? I mentioned that I generally apply those pins in an antegrade fashion. So I insert the pin from the proximal femur to the distal femur. This is in general the recommended method to reduce the risk of sciatic nerve impingement. And this can allow the application of a tie-in IM configuration plus a closed approach or an open but do not touch approach. I hope that answered the question. There's another question I can see from one of the delegates. It's regarding pre-drilling of the hole. Yes, it can be occasionally quite tricky. You pre-drill the hole and then you try to insert the final pin, but then the you might not be able to find the pre-drilled hole, and that might then reduce your motivation to pre-drill, which you should pre-drill all the times to reduce the heat damage. So what I usually do when I pre-drill a hole, straight away after removing the drill bit, I insert a blue or a green cannula, and then I change the attachment of the drill and then insert the pin. So this can prevent to lose the drill hole. Right, are there any other questions? Doesn't seem to be any more questions. So many thanks for your attention, and I hand over now to Ema.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Hans for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.